Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page, and I would like to introduce my guest co-host, Dr. Amir Barzan, one of our chief resident physicians at UNC Family Medicine, who is filling in for Adam today. Welcome, Amir.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Page. I'm really looking forward to being on the show today.
You're going to have to call me Christy today, okay?
I will.
You can do it. On our show, we are going to be talking with Dr. James Finch, past president of the North Carolina Society of Addiction Medicine, about marijuana use and addiction.
Which I think is going to be a great subject, given that we've had a lot of states step forward and legalize the use of marijuana, and medical marijuana is coming to the forefront on many bills and legislation.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a hot topic, and there are just so many people using and abusing marijuana, some with questions of maybe it's okay and maybe it's not dangerous, and now that it's becoming legalized, maybe, you know, there's just lots of questions. So I think we'll be able to hopefully address some of that today with an expert.
Absolutely. Looking It'll be a great discussion.
Well, first, we've got some research that matters. Amir, we're going to talk about adults with disabilities, and we're going to talk about exercise and obesity.
We're going to also talk about the differences in the effects of alcohol and energy drinks and some issues with low back pain and treatment options that we were using before and whether or not they're as effective as we thought that they were.
Yep. So let's jump right in. Adults with disabilities. So this is really common. 21.5 million U.S. adults that are 18 to 64 years of age have a serious limitation or what's considered a disability in their hearing or their vision or their thinking or their ability to move around. And that group has a much higher risk of having a chronic disease that could be benefited by or prevented by activity.
That's right. And this recent study that was published in the Journal of American Medical Association, or JAMA, showed that about 10.1 million inactive adults with a disability, 46.3% of them had at least one chronic disease in comparison to 31.1% of the 6.7 million active adults with disabilities and one or more chronic diseases.
And inactive adults with disabilities, so people who have disabilities that aren't moving around and getting exercise, they were 50% more likely to have a chronic disease than those who did regular exercise, which they defined by moving for 150 minutes or more weekly of moderate intensity aerobic physical activity, or at least 75 minutes a week of really hardcore, vigorous intensity aerobic activity. And this was a study looking at how much people get advice from their doctors related to this.
Yeah, which I think is a really great point, because I think that this is something maybe that we overlook at times because we're trying to address bigger issues and we forget to think about how important physical activity can be in all of our populations that we treat.
It's true. And that's what the study found, that even though we know that there are high chronic disease rates and low physical activity levels among adults with disabilities, that very few of the adults who visited a health professional during the previous 12 months had any recommendation from their doctor about physical activity, just really highlighting that we're not doing well enough. The people who did get that recommendation from their doctor were more likely to start doing some physical activity. So that shows some hope. We need to do a better job. If you're a person out there with a disability or you have a loved one with a disability, we just want to be sure we're doing our job today by saying, yes, you want to get yourself moving. If you're limited in mobility or able to get around, there are other exercises that you can do. So that's important to talk with your doctor or physical therapist about.
Absolutely. Something to look forward to helping treat our patients in our clinics. The next research that matters now to discuss is the work of exercise or lack thereof and our BMI or body mass index. And a publication in the American Journal of Medicine showed that over the last 20 years, there's been a sharp drop in physical exercise and an increase in average BMI or body mass index, but that average calorie intake has remained about the same.
Yeah. So, I mean, we know that Americans are getting, you know, I tell my children not to use the word fat, but Americans are getting fatter by way we've got this obesity epidemic. And I think this is important and sort of actionable information that our diets really haven't changed over 20 years in America. We're continuing to get larger. And then what this study showed is that people are exercising significantly less. So, I mean, the number of U.S. women who reported doing no physical activity went from 19.1 in 1994 to 51.7. So now, like, almost 52% of women report doing no exercise.
And that number is very similar for our male population, which in 1994 was 11.4% and up to 43.5% in 2010. Just goes to show you that no matter who the population is that we're talking to, it really is physical activity that is hindering our ability to lose that weight, and maybe not as much on the consumption side.
Yeah, I mean, it draws us to conclude that the problem that we have is the lack of exercise, not so much on the calories. The calories do matter also, but we've really got to find a way to get ourselves moving.
Absolutely, and this is kind of coattailing or parlaying with our last comment about physical activity. So make sure we're out there moving and taking care of ourselves.
Yep, I exercised today already.
I'm going to after we do the radio show.
Good. All right. Well, let's talk about alcohol and energy drinks. So these things are so popular.
Very, very common, especially in the college age group. Very many people out there, whenever they drink, use other energy drink substances to help continue their drinking throughout the day. And this was actually a recent study that was published in the journal Alcoholism, Clinical and Experimental Research, that looked at the effects of alcohol and energy drink consumption amongst two different populations.
Yeah, so they did this study where these are, I almost said kids, but young adults between 18 and 30, and they were either just given alcohol mixed in a drink that they didn't know it was in it, but they knew it was alcohol, or a drink with alcohol and an energy drink combination. They used Red Bull energy drink. And what they did, they followed them through the night, and the people who had both alcohol and the energy drink had a stronger desire to continue drinking through the night than the group who just had alcohol without the energy drink. So they were like more motivated to drink more.
Yeah, which is a really, really interesting thought, considering the fact that this energy drink industry is continuing to grow. And some people say that it'll grow up into the $4 billion mark in the years to come. And alcohol use is a bigger issue going forward with many of our age populations, especially our college-age students.
Yeah, I think this was a small study, and it's the beginning of us understanding these things. But I think just some general common sense would tell you that mixing different substances and drugs is, like, not a great idea, especially when they're mind-altering ones like alcohol. So be careful out there what you do.
Yeah, be cautious next time you order that Red Bull and vodka.
Exactly. Okay, let's do this last one, which is about this common back and leg pain treatment called steroid injections for spinal stenosis.
And spinal stenosis, for those of you who don't know, is a condition in which the spaces between the spine narrow, putting pressure on the nerves and causes pain or numbness in the back and in the legs.
And so it's very common that some people will get these injections placed into their back, and that usually has a steroid and sort of a local numbing anesthetic in it to try to help people have less pain and be able to function more.
And in a recent article published in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that steroid injections for spinal stenosis may actually provide little to no benefit for many patients, which is a little bit different than what we thought before.
Yeah, I mean, this was a really large randomized trial, over 400 patients, 16 different sites. So, I mean, a pretty large trial showing that whether you got an injection with just the numbing medicine or it had steroid with it, that really there was not a big difference in pain and function after 6 weeks. So it doesn't mean that it's, to me, I'll be interested in your thought, but to me, this doesn't mean that it's absolutely wrong to try that, but it may make us want to be more cautious and certainly try to understand it a little bit more if at a population level it doesn't make a difference. I've had some patients where they feel like they do get benefit, but this says at a population level, maybe not.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is one of the harder parts to treat in medicine, and being an osteopathic physician, I do see a lot of patients with low back pain, and it is very difficult because you do get response in some patients with the injections, and sometimes they're the ones who benefit, but, you know, we spend a lot of money on a global level on these injections. So it may be something to reconsider.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we have to take a break. That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We've talked about some good things, back pain treatments, alcohol plus energy drinks. Be careful.
The importance of using exercise and then making sure that we're promoting exercise in our patients with disabilities.
Absolutely. So we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. James Finch, past president of the North Carolina Society of Addiction Medicine, about marijuana use and addiction. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzan.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzan. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. James Finch, past president of the North Carolina Society of Addiction Medicine, about marijuana use and addiction.
Welcome, Dr. Finch. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Happy to be here. It's a good topic.
Yeah, it's a great topic and near and dear to you. So you are a family physician with 25 years of experience and a real expert in addiction medicine. Tell us your story. How did you become so interested in addiction? How did that come on to play in your training as a family physician?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question to ask because everybody brings their history to any of these kind of discussions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your personal background, your personal experience, family experience. And for me, that's relatively similar to a lot of folks. In other words, I had a few family members that had alcohol problems in particular. Mm. But I also learned at an early age that people can get better from that. So I had an uncle that was a great guy, chronic alcoholic, went into the hospital for his fifth or sixth visit. And his family doc came and sat on the edge of the bed, said, "Jack, you know, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to be dead in 6 months. Your kids are going to be orphans. Your wife's going to be a widow. You got to stop drinking." He did. He never drank again, never went to a meeting, never went to rehab, never went to anything else. He just pulled himself up and stopped drinking.
And that was your uncle.
That was my uncle. Wow. So I learned at an early age that people can have problems, but they can get better, and that a individual can have an impact on that depending on what they say to them. And so I sort of carried that with me as I went through training. I think the other thing that's useful about my background is I am a family physician, so I am a generalist by nature. And I came into this not as an addiction professional, but as a family doc that got more and more interested in it, saw more and more people with drug problems, spent more and more of my time and interest in that, and finally shifted over. So I don't have, for example, a prohibitionist kind of perspective, which some folks do that come into addiction medicine. I like to look at the evidence, see what's right and what's wrong, and try and apply it.
Sounds like a true family doctor right there, talking to two other family doctors. Yep. So we're all like-minded in thinking about the whole person and what mm-hmm. is the evidence really mm-hmm. behind what we recommend.
Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that it strikes me about this conversation that we're going to have is there's been a lot of discussion, especially with Colorado stepping forward and allowing the use of recreational marijuana, and more people are talking about marijuana these days. Mm-hmm. How have you seen that play out in what you do on a daily basis in terms of are more people coming to you and being more honest about their marijuana use and saying that they may or may not think that it's an issue?
Well, I'm having more and more of my patients coming in saying they'd like to move to Colorado. I think there's a lot of discussion about it, and of course there's the question inevitably comes up, is North Carolina going to follow suit? And you have to say, well, there's the possibility. You never know where that's going to go. And personally, I think that's going to depend on how much tax revenue comes into Colorado and Washington and, mm-hmm. and how that gets used by the state legislatures. So, but we don't know how that's going to play out in this particular state. And so folks have to deal with the reality of the fact that marijuana is illegal in North Carolina and you can get into trouble with it. And so that's what I see a lot of people who have gotten into trouble with their cannabis. And usually it's marijuana, although there is hash and other hashish and other types. But people that come in that have either had problems and end up needing treatment, or they've had problems with other drugs, and then the marijuana becomes more prominent once they take care of those drugs.
So let's talk a little bit about marijuana use and its effects. And then I'd like to get into the difference between using it and addictive behaviors. Mm-hmm. Because we toss these words around a lot of times. And with marijuana use, it's a little different in my mind than with some of these other, like crack cocaine or something, sure, with a different kind of addiction. Tell us a little bit about what we know about people using marijuana and the difference between this addiction term.
Mm-hmm. No, it's an important thing to bring up because, well, number one, in terms of use, a lot of people do use. So there are a lot of people out there that have either tried marijuana or are using it on some sort of a regular basis.
A lot of professionals. I mean, I'm shocked by mm-hmm. my patient panel when people mm-hmm. just tell me what they're doing. A lot of people are just sort of casually, every now and then, smoking pot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not just our patients. We're in a generational cohort that there are people out there that we know that are
exactly.
smoking, and we know them as active professionals or active individuals in one way or another. So it's definitely one of the more common drugs used. And so it is important to make a distinction between use of it, overuse or problematic use, and dependent or addictive use.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so that's a lot of terms. Let's
it is. It is. But it sort of sets up in my mind a continuum. And you can uh-huh. almost think of it as a triangle sort of turned on its side. You've got almost any drug you talk about, whether it's alcohol or cannabis or cocaine or anything else, there are going to be a lot of people that use the drug. There are going to be a smaller percentage of people, as the triangle sort of narrows down, who use it problematically or at risk. And then there's going to be a small percentage of people, the tip of the iceberg, as it were, the tip of the triangle, who actually become addicted to it, who use it in a problematic way, serious problems in their life, recurring problems, and yet they can't seem to control it. They can't seem to control and manage their use. They continue to have problems. They're using it compulsively. They're using it in such a way that it's out of control. So there, you know, it's worth getting that out on the table right at the beginning, that people can become addicted to cannabis, can become addicted to marijuana, just like they can become addicted to alcohol or nicotine or cocaine. So, you know, one of the dilemmas we have in trying to talk about marijuana is that it often turns into a very partisan conversation. You've got people that have very strong opinions on both sides. So you'll hear people that make it sound like you smoke marijuana at all and you're going to end up having a serious problem with it. And you have other people that say, oh, it's this natural substance
that's fine.
It's fine. No problem. No
and
risk.
And then the gateway drug argument.
So it's it is important to acknowledge that any drug that has psychoactive properties, that is, it can change your mood or change your perception or change your how you feel, has the potential for overuse and misuse and addiction. And marijuana is certainly in that category. That said, and this is one of those things where you have to hold two things in mind at the same time. That said, of all the people that use marijuana, very few get addicted. And it's like, the figure that gets bantered around is about 9 or 10%, and that's not that dissimilar from the figures that you hear for other drugs.
Sure. So alcohol seems like, I don't know what the mm-hmm. percentages are for alcohol, but it seems similar.
Very similar. So it's always worth keeping in mind that although some people do get addicted, a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. And so when we start talking about issues like risks or consequences from use, a lot of that has to do with people that are using fairly regularly or heavily. So if you talk about chronic lung disease or lung cancer or those sorts of things, those are typically heavy users. So one of the dilemmas we've got as clinicians and as citizens and family members and whatnot is that we don't have a lot of good data on less frequent users, the person that uses now and then, that uses several times a week or whatnot. And that's most people who use marijuana are those sort of casual, occasional users. There's a smaller, significant percentage that are very regular users, and then the small percentage that are actually addicted.
What kinds of problems do you see for people who are smoking a lot of marijuana or becoming addicted? Mm-hmm. I have patients who have problems with depression or problems with sleep or problems with motivation. Mm-hmm. And if they're smoking pot every day, that mm-hmm. seems like a reasonable thing to try to, to try to back off on. But
yeah.
Absolutely. What kinds of things do you see?
Absolutely. And it's one of the things that both clinicians often overlook and that individuals overlook. They see it as something they do to help them sleep or whatnot, but mm-hmm. if it's something they're doing regularly, it is having an effect on their mood and cognition. Again, we've got this dilemma that we know heavy use is going to make those things worse. You know, I have patients that come in and say, you know, having a little bit of pot at bedtime helps my pain, and I have no reason to disbelieve them.
That sounds like a great segue to the end of the conversation for right now, but we'll need to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. James Finch, past president of the North Carolina Society of Addiction Medicine, about marijuana use and addiction. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzin.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzin. We've been talking with Dr. James Finch, past president of the North Carolina Society of Addiction Medicine, about marijuana use and addiction. And Dr. Finch, I'd love for you've talked a little bit and referenced the evidence, and I know mm-hmm. you're, as a family mm-hmm. doctor, you care about mm-hmm. about real scientific studies and what we know. Tell us and our listeners, what do we know about the harms of marijuana? Mm-hmm.
Well, there's what we know and what we don't know, and unfortunately, there's still a lot we don't know, mm-hmm. and I think, again, some of these big public health experiments that are being done in Colorado and Washington are going to give us more information as that comes in, but nonetheless, there is a fair amount we know, and again, as I said earlier, some of the consequences relate to heavy users, so lung disease, that sort of thing, heavy users. On the other hand, you don't have to be a heavy user to get into an automobile accident. So there's a significant risk for people that smoke or use any kind of cannabis or any kind of marijuana product and then drive. And that's very clear. It's, you know, and all the people that say, oh, no, I can drive great, just like the people that say, I can have a couple of drinks and drive fine.
Yeah, or I drive better when I'm high. Oh, yeah, I'm like, yeah, no. Yeah,
right. And I bounce. It's softer when I fall, and all those things that people say. So, but the data is very clear, and it doesn't need to be equivocal at all that a person, particularly early on in their smoking, or particularly when they've just smoked and the sort of blood levels are on the rise, that they are significantly impaired. Their reaction time, their ability to react to situations is impaired. So it's very clear that there's a risk there. Mm-hmm. The other body of evidence that's growing and is really worrisome is the consequences for young users. And by young, that means younger than 18, crudely speaking, but the younger someone starts using marijuana or cannabis products, and particularly if they use regularly, there's an increased risk of significant cognitive impairment, and that cognitive impairment, the evidence is mounting, can be permanent. And so we all know, we've had a lot of studies for a while showing that if somebody smokes some pot, they're clearly cognitively impaired at the time. That's kind of the point, is to mm-hmm. get a little impaired.
Not thinking clearly.
Right. So, but the data is that they aren't really fully back online for a couple of days. So somebody that smokes pot on a Saturday night, Monday morning, he's still not really hitting on all cylinders. Mm. Now, interestingly enough, the data is very similar for a binge drinker. So we don't need to sort of focus exclusively on marijuana. So we've known that there were these persistent effects, transient effects, that didn't clear up just because the person wasn't high anymore. But now there's a growing body of evidence that for adolescents, if they start smoking and they smoke regularly, it can have a significant effect on cognitive ability, focus, problem solving, memory, and that tends to be residual. And so there's increasing evidence that even if they stop smoking, they'll still have had some impairment that'll persist. And so I think in terms of prevention, one of the big messages, you know, as we have all these folks talking about, oh, it's not a bad drug and adults can use it and all that, is we need to be really careful about trying to do our best to delay onset of use. So every year we can delay, just like with alcohol, every year we can delay an adolescent using alcohol or marijuana, the less likely they are to have ultimately have problems.
And I mean, it seems like a that makes a lot of sense to target that population. And it's pretty darn common in early teenagers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's...
Relatively. So again, we have to be careful about, the percentages are something like 40% of adolescents have tried marijuana by the time they're in college, that kind of stuff. But the percentages that actually start at 13, 14, 15 are lower, thankfully. Mm-hmm. And so for parents and for educators and for clinicians to know, that's something to start asking about early, mm-hmm. and to give that message.
Because you're saying it may have some permanent damage to mm-hmm. the brain.
There is that potential. Yeah, that's the evidence is pointing in that direction and it's mounting. And again, it tends to be, the heavier the use and the earlier the use. Mm. So again, just because your kid has smoked some pot now and then or whatnot doesn't mean they're going to shave off too many IQ points. But if you're concerned that they are a more regular smoker and they're under this 18 age limit, then that really is something to be concerned about and try and get them help for.
Wow.
Now, do you see a correlation between these young users and use of other drugs, such as cocaine, heroin, or alcohol?
Well, the whole idea of marijuana being a gateway drug is the concept that I think you're asking about. And yes, there is it certainly is a gateway drug for some. There is an increased risk that anyone who uses marijuana will use other drugs. There's an increased risk compared to the general population. On the other hand, most of them don't go on to use other drugs. And for most of them, alcohol and nicotine was a gateway drug before marijuana was a gateway drug. And really scary for me, again, as a physician who prescribes and sees patients, is getting into your parents' medicine cabinet and taking their Xanax or their oxycodone or their Percocet is increasingly a gateway drug.
So absolutely.
There's a large number of adolescents now where the first drug they use to quote-unquote get high is one of their parents' pain pills or tranquilizers.
So this is really something as parents and grandparents that we need to be paying attention to, both with marijuana use and exposure, but also with the opioids. And mm-hmm. these are things, I don't have teenagers yet, but it's not far away. So these are things I'm noting to myself.
We don't need to wait for teenage, unfortunately.
They
can start earlier. But yeah, that's a whole other discussion that I think is really an extremely important public health discussion, because prescription medication abuse is now, following alcohol and nicotine, the number one drug problem.
And what do we know so far about legalization of marijuana and increased use among teenagers? Mm-hmm. Does that make it less hip to smoke pot because it's not illegal anymore?
A couple of responses to that is that, interestingly enough, the perceived risk of smoking marijuana has decreased in adolescence. So even as some of this evidence is coming out, the contrary has been happening on the street, where there's actually less perception of risk. But again, there's this sort of whole public health risk that we need to kind of keep in mind. And so one of the things that I think is going to be really interesting in terms of the legalization issue is it's very well established that if you increase access to a drug, you will have more problems with that drug. So it mm-hmm. is absolutely anticipated that states that are making this legal, they will have more people having problems with marijuana because it's just more available. On the other hand, what that does to overall public health is going to be interesting. Years ago, I did a workshop for a bunch of primary care docs at an Air Force base, a military base. This was back in the 80s. And I got there with my colleagues to do this workshop on alcohol abuse. And the docs, it became clear, were really ticked off. And they were ticked off because the military had just implemented its zero tolerance policy. And that meant they'd been drug screening all these recruits and all these young guys. And, of course, what they were mostly finding was marijuana, because that's how it is. Mm-hmm. And all these guys had to stop smoking marijuana because it was a zero tolerance. The docs were ticked off because they said the past year, all the incidents of fights, arrests, automobile accidents, accidents of all kind had gone up. So when these young men who were determined to get high one way or another didn't have marijuana as an access, they shifted to alcohol. And the morbidity with alcohol, we know, is serious. So it's going to be interesting to see, there is this risk of increased problems with marijuana. Be interesting to see if the problems with alcohol, with binge drinking, actually go down a little bit and the overall public health burden actually drops.
Interesting.
So waiting for the data.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Waiting to know. So for our listeners, I know we have to wrap up. That leads me to so many other questions. We'll have to have you back at some point. But for our listeners who want to get information about this, it's easy to get extreme information on either end about drug use and misuse and addiction. Where can people go? Do you have a website or for information about addiction and information about marijuana specifically?
Well, certainly the federal agencies, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, National Institutes of Drug Abuse, have websites with a lot of information for parents and others, and it can be useful information. If you want
How would you find those websites?
If you just Google Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, you'll find Mental Health Services Administration.
Mm-hmm, okay.
Or National Institutes of Drug Abuse.
Dr. Finch, we can't thank you enough for this fruitful and enlightening conversation about addiction medicine and marijuana use and the effects that it can have on our adolescents and our adult populations. And we wanted to just thank you for coming and talking with us. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. And you're listening to Your Health Radio with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzan.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Amir and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And now we'll have our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, read us our very first House Call question of the day.
I'm 70 years old and have osteoporosis. I'm taking Fosamax for my bones, but developed severe stomach problems and a rotten tooth. My doctor said I needed to stop the medicine. Do you think this is due to the medication? If so, what else can I do for my bones?
This is a great question and something that is actually coming to the forefront recently with all the new studies coming out on the importance of calcium and vitamin D. And while your question addresses the stomach problems and a rotten tooth, those can be tied to the medications that we commonly give women to treat osteoporosis.
And that Fosamax is a bisphosphonate, which is just a fancy word for the class of medicine. And it's well proven to increase the strength of your bones, the density of your bones, and to delay the time that you have a fracture or a break of one of your bones. And a hip fracture is a really big deal. So if you have osteoporosis, we prefer, if possible, for people to be on these bisphosphonates because they're very good.
Now, with that being said, there are people who do have side effect problems from the medications, which sounds like you might be having. And other things that you can do are just to increase your calcium intake through your diet by eating foods that are rich in dairy. And then also by taking a vitamin D supplement, which has been now shown to decrease the risk of falls.
Mm-hmm. And I would say this is one of those things you have to sort of weigh out, like, for some people, those stomach side effects are just so bad, they just can't tolerate it, and they just can't do it. And other people say, well, I really don't like that, but I really don't want to have a hip fracture, which is dangerous to your life. And so some people weigh that out and say, well, gosh, this is terrible, but I'll just keep doing it because it's good for my bones. Some of that also might have to do with the history of your bone health and like what your scans of your bones have shown. So you want to kind of talk about the details of that with your doctor. There are some alternative medicines that you could also pursue potentially.
Absolutely. Just like in anything that we recommend, it's always a good idea to have a conversation with your physician about these products and these options out there for treatment and to come up with a plan that works for you.
All right, let's take our very next house call. Erica?
A friend of mine recently had surgery for gallbladder volvulus. I thought the only type of volvulus were those of the intestines. I've never heard of this. Is it common?
No, not common to have a gallbladder volvulus. But I guess we maybe should start with the word volvulus, and we'll give our best description of it, but we'll ask our fantastic health sciences librarians. They're so smart and capable to post something on our blog about the word volvulus and what it means.
Absolutely. So in the most plain terms of what a volvulus is, it's whenever something gets twisted upon itself. Commonly, that's with the intestines spinning around themselves and getting twisted to where the blood flow is cut off to that area of the intestines. In this situation, a gallbladder volvulus is very uncommon, but basically happens when the gallbladder twists around a piece of fat that's around your stomach.
And it's kind of a big deal. So getting that taken care of, if any part of your body does this, it can be dangerous. And so if that happens and it doesn't sort of fold back, usually it's twisted in a way that it can't. And that is something that requires surgery. So nothing for you to be necessarily worried about, because that particular thing is not super common. But a great question to teach all of us about this word volvulus. And sounds like you're being supportive to your friend, which is also really sweet.
Absolutely.
Erica, let's have our next house call question.
I recently sent my physician a request to be friends on Facebook. When I saw him at my next appointment, he said he wouldn't accept the request because it might damage our relationship. I was extremely surprised. What do you think?
Ooh, I bet if you asked a bunch of different doctors, you'd get some slightly different opinions and practices around this issue. What do you think, Amir?
Yeah, I think that this is a very, very interesting topic. Social media has just exploded recently within the past few years. And I think that there's a range of emotions tied into something like this. Some physicians would say that the role of being a physician is to be accessible, and that means being there for their patients in any kind of form or fashion. And others may say that there should be a professional, personal distinction in the relationship that you have with patients, and that might be the reason why your physician told you he wouldn't accept his invitation.
Yeah, I think and people have different Facebook practices. I mean, I don't go on there very much. So if someone's invited me to be your friend and I didn't respond, it's just because I don't really go there very much. But I do think we learn as physicians the importance of having some of these boundaries and maintaining a really professional interaction with our patients. Sometimes that gets muddy in community with people, or if you're in the same church or you're in the same community, that you can be friends and also be a doctor. And a good doctor, but it's important for us to reflect on these. So, I mean, I think it's good that you had a very open conversation and that your doctor wasn't saying, I don't want to be your friend, just like, I don't want to share the Facebook space.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting in my household. My wife is a photographer and uses social media about as much as anyone can. And I don't actually have any social media accounts. So it's an interesting practice to see on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. But good for you for communicating openly and having that conversation with your doctor.
Absolutely.
I think that says a lot about your relationship, that you're able to sort of talk about that instead of somebody having their feelings hurt.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that that's a sign of a good relationship with your doctor.
I do too. Okay, let's take our next, even if you won't be your friend on Facebook. But, okay, let's take our very next house call question, our last house call question of the day.
I woke up recently and had severe pain in my lower neck, right below the Adam's apple. I didn't have a fever and my throat seemed okay. This lasted for 3 days. What might this have been?
Wow. You're not jumping in there, Amir.
Yeah, this one has me scratching my head a little bit here. There's a lot of things that could be going on, and I think it would be very difficult to tell you exactly what it could have been. And I think that this is something sometimes we see commonly in medicine, where after a few days of having symptoms, something goes away and seems like we don't really have a good answer of why that happened.
Yeah. And, you know, when you say right below the Adam's apple, I'm wondering, is that like on the outside of your neck or like inside where your throat is? It says your throat seemed okay. But a lot of times people will have a lot of pain related to postnasal drip, where it's usually worse in the morning after you've been laying down. And you can have real pain there if that's irritated the back of your throat, and that can be from allergies or a virus or a variety of things. Good news is it sounds like it's gotten better for you. So we may not have the best explanation for it, but we're really glad that it went away.
Very glad that it went away. And just like in any situation, it's always good to kind of keep these things in mind. And if it doesn't get better, to talk to your physician about them.
All right, Amir. So we've talked a little bit about osteoporosis medication, about volvulus and what that means.
We've also talked about the importance of Facebook and professional and social relationships, and a little bit about neck pain and what it can and cannot be, and the importance of things getting better over time.
Yeah, so that does wrap up our house calls for the day. And we thank you for joining us today for the show for your health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We want you to share your questions and stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, on Facebook. You can follow us. We'll We'll check it. And iTunes, we also, if you go to iTunes, you can get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. James Finch. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Amir Barzin.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.